It's 6:10 on March 4th, 2013, and we're back in session. We're on Senate File 872. Senator Franzen, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening, members. Senate File 872 is here for your consideration. It's an agency bill with Department of Health and Human Services dealing with fair hearings, internal audit provisions, and establishing the Cultural and Ethnic Leadership Communities Council. With that, I will have four testifiers to go through each article and the changes therein, starting with Mr. Joel Rubenstein from DHS on my right.
Thank you.
Oh, and I do have an author's amendment. Thank
but
you.
We now have a quorum. Okay, Senator Franzen offers the A2 author's amendment to Senate File 872. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Please
proceed,
Senator.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. My name is Joseph Rubenstein. I'm a human services judge with the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Almost swallow the microphone. We've been having a terrible time with these microphones
right
today. Thank you.
All right. Article 1, by and large, are technical and conforming changes that we would like to ask the legislature to make to the fair hearing statutes. The first change on page 1, lines 1.24 to 1.27, is to conform the statute to the department's longstanding practices of hiring only lawyers admitted to practice and in good standing with the bar in the state of Minnesota as human services judges. The next change on page 3 of the bill eliminates lines through the language you see in 3.9 through 3.14. This language was moved as a result of a prior bill, and it's given rise to a questionable reading of the statute. The statute can be read to say that the 30 and 90-day periods for filing appeals only apply to maltreatment hearings. We propose to eliminate this reading by eliminating that language and placing it in a new Section H, which appears on pages 4.84, page lines 18 through 32. On lines 7.16 through 7.19, we're asking to make explicit what we believe is our implicit authority to issue rulings and orders while a case is pending in order to manage the case. This language also makes it clear that those rulings and orders are only reviewable in the context of a request for reconsideration or an appeal to the district court. The next amendment is on lines 7.23 and 7.24. This amendment is intended to make clear that the requirement to ask that a dismissal be set aside based on a failure to appear, that the 10-day period begin to run after the date of the dismissal, and to ask that the request be filed in writing. Right now, it's not clear when the 10-day period begins to run, and we can get phone calls. People say they've called, so it's not at all clear when these requests are timely. I did skip one. I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. On page 5, lines 5.9 through 5.11, would give the department the right to grant a request for an in-person hearing, either in person or by interactive video technology. Right now, if somebody wants an in-person hearing, we have to physically travel to their county seat. At the same time, the department The department has its own video conferencing system set up at every county in this state, and we don't anticipate that there will be any particular monetary savings if this request is adopted. But what it will do is to provide us additional time to hear cases and write decisions, because most of the time when we go to a county seat to provide a hearing in person, that's at least one day that we're out of the office and doing nothing but traveling. And this is especially important to us in view of the fact that in 2007 we were hearing about 6,400 cases a year. Last year, for the year ended December 31st, that number was just a shade under 10,000. And we do anticipate that that's going to continue to increase in the foreseeable future. On page 8, lines 8.11 through 8.16, this requires a bit of explanation. As the law now stands, if the same set of circumstances giving rise to a maltreatment determination involving a minor also gives rise to a district court proceeding, then the law requires that we suspend our proceedings until the proceedings in the district court are completed. The law is silent as to whether we are obligated to do the same thing when the maltreatment involves a vulnerable adult. As a matter of practice, we have been suspending those kinds of appeals until the district court proceedings are complete, because I think a lot of people are naturally reluctant to give testimony under oath in our proceedings, which can be used against them in district court, until those proceedings in district court have been finished. And so this is we're asking to conform the practice in statute. On page 9, lines 9.21 to 9.23, if an appellant is dissatisfied with the decision that we issued, they can do one or both of the following. They can ask one of the chief judges to reconsider and change the decision. They can appeal it directly to the district court, or they can ask that the decision be reconsidered, and if they're not satisfied with that, then they can go to district court. We oftentimes get requests for reconsideration with additional evidence. So this amendment simply limits the right to provide this additional information to those circumstances where there can be some kind of a showing that it wasn't available to the person at the time of the hearing, or that it was not where they could get at it with a reasonable effort. We believe that this is necessary in order to avoid situations where people, where there's an attempt to basically retry the case a second time on reconsideration.
And Mr. Rubenstein,
yes.
You also changed the number of days on line 9.16. Would you talk about why you think that's important?
Yes, I'm sorry. We understand that people are oftentimes going to want to have things reconsidered, but we would like to have the request, if they believe that we've made an error, we would like to have it brought to our attention a little more promptly and while the matter is perhaps a little fresher. These days, people have the ability to file requests for reconsideration. They can mail them, they can fax them, they can email them. There are a whole variety of technologies which make it a lot easier for people to bring to our attention what they believe are errors in the decisions that we've made. And with our increasing caseload, we would like to have people bring those to our attention a little sooner rather than a little later. And on page 8, lines 8.11 through 8.16, this is technical. Right now, we are in most cases required to issue decisions within a net of 90 days after the appeal is filed. Again, there are cases involving appeals of maltreatment that also may give rise to other actions, such as a licensing action. And some of these cases, when they do give rise to licensing and other kinds of actions, are combined and heard by the Office of Administrative Hearing. It also does take a while for the licensing division to let us know whether there are any such other actions out there. So this amendment will say that the 90-day period we have to get cases out begins running after the later the date that the licensing authority tells us that any other matters are final, or the date that the last appeal is filed, so that the matters can be consolidated and then we don't run into a time bind with our appeals. And the last change on page 10, lines 10.4 to 10.8, is a revisor's instruction to conform our title to the working title that we have had for several years. The statute, we're now referred to in statutes as Human Services Referee or Appeals Examiner. At the time that fair hearings were instituted, most of the people involved were not lawyers. Now, I think with one exception, everyone is a lawyer. We've been using the working title Human Services Judge for several years, and we're asking that the statute be conformed to reflect that practice.
Thank you. That's all of Article 1.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Would you tell us what your role is with DHS, Mr. Rubenstein?
Yes, I'm a human services judge. I hear appeals of all kinds, any appeals arising under the Fair Hearing Statute. I hear cases involving maltreatment of minors and vulnerable adults for both the Department and the Department of Health, also occasionally the Department of Education.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll now move to Article 2. And on our materials here, we have Antonia Wilcoxon, who is here to talk about Article 2, followed by Gary Johnson, who will be covering Article 3. Is this Gary?
Mr. Johnson was not able to be here today, Chairwoman. So I'm Christina Baltus. I'll be representing him.
When it gets to Article 3, will you spell your last name for us?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are you Antonia?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Please begin. Article 2.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of this committee, Senator Franson. Thank you very much for sponsoring this bill. The purpose of the council is to advise the Commission of Human Services on reducing disparities between racial and ethnic groups within the department and through the services it provides. A disparities reduction advisory committee consisting of representatives from diverse communities and a group of DHS employees appointed by their assistant commissioners has been meeting for the past 3.5 years. This bill will empower the current group in a more formal role within the agency to make recommendations to the commissioner. This bill establishes the duties of the commissioner, the duties of the council, and the duties of the council members. As a means of a background, the Department of Human Services is a public agency and responsible for helping people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. This responsibility demands that services and outcomes be provided equitably and without regard to race or ethnicity. Research data shows that serious disparities exist between racial and ethnic groups and the services and outcomes funded through the Department of Human Services. It is not only a moral imperative to reduce disparities in services and outcomes, but in the public interest to live in a state where all people live in dignity and have the opportunity to achieve their highest potential. Despite the department's best efforts thus far to reduce disparities, such disparities still exist. Elected officials, policymakers, and stakeholders agree that more effective strategies could be implemented with advice and input from the groups in which disparities exist. Minnesota has the potential to save lives and dollars by taking steps to achieve the highest level of health for all people, that is, health equity. This outcome has the greatest likelihood of being achieved if the communities most affected by health disparities are included in the problem-solving process. A report by the National Academy for State Health Policy in August of 2012 states that improvements in health and for racial and ethnic minorities and American Indians will increase the state's social and financial capital. In 2010, 30% of Hispanics and 17% of blacks in Minnesota were uninsured, compared to 7% of the white population. Insurance status alone will not amend disparities. However, ability to purchase health insurance will have significant implications for individuals unable to receive care due to the high cost of health care. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation for 2010-2011, the poverty rate in Minnesota is 48% for blacks, 35% for Hispanics, 28% for others, and 9% for whites. In Minnesota, 10% of residents speak a language other than English in the household. The unemployment rate for blacks is more than three times that for whites, with 10% of blacks and 3% of whites out of work for more than 1 year. I thank you, Madam Chair, members of this committee, and Senator.
Thank you. I would just say at this point for the members of the committee, you'll remember that Senator Hayden presented a bill related to this development of this council. And we pulled it out of the bill specifically because we wanted to address, because disparities is an issue that we're trying to highlight and follow, not just this legislative session, but in follow-up evaluation. So we have heard the essence of this language. The only difference in this bill from Senator Hayden's bill is on line page 11, line 11.8 and 11.9, at which in this bill language there is no compensation for members of the council, but in Senator Hayden's bill he did include some compensation for the council. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Shall we move to Article 3?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christina Baltes, B-A-L-T-E-S, and I'm a manager in the Commissioner's Office. And Article 3, lines 12.33 and 12.34, removes the General Assistance Medical Care, which is no longer applicable. And it adds language then, and line 13.1, to allow the Commissioner to conduct compliance reviews on any additional programs that the legislature brings forward or that DHS faces. An example of that would be the Min Choices program that was just enacted last year. In line 13.9 and 13.10, it will give the commissioner or the commissioner's representative the authority to issue an administrative subpoena as needed in administering the compliance system. A lot of times our recipients don't have their current pay stubs or pay stubs from an employer that they are no longer employed at. This will give us the ability then when we're doing compliance reviews to go and get the pay stubs so that the recipients themselves are not in jeopardy of losing care and losing their Medicaid or their Minnesota care. In addition, lines 13-11, I'm sorry. So that was it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Would you spell your last name for us?
Sure. B as in boy, A L, T as in Tom, E as in England, S as in Sam.
Thank you, Bolton. And Our final testifier that I have named here is Kate Lerner from DHS, who's going to cover Article 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kate Lerner, I'm the Director of County Relations with the Department of Human Services. Article 4 encompasses a variety of technical changes. As the bill summary articulates, these changes came about from work completed by the Steering Committee on Performance and Outcome Reforms. This was a committee that was established by the 2009 legislature. Its overarching aim was to create a series of performance measures and outcomes that counties would be held accountable for achieving for those human services programs that they deliver on behalf of the Department of Human Services and the state. And as part of that mandate to the committee was charged with developing a set of recommendations around statutes, rules, reports, regulations that should be repealed because they are obsolete. And so this is the first series of those recommendations. All of the changes that are included within this article of the bill are indeed technical. You should have in your packet of information a table that outlines in what I think clearer language than what you'll see in bill language each of the changes that are proposed within the bill and the rationale behind why they are considered obsolete. So all of them are pretty simple. I think the table that's included hopefully answers any questions you might have, but I certainly would welcome any if there are some.
And that's the essence, is that it is eliminating this set of repealing these statutes.
That is correct. The one point that I will mention in the author's amendment that was offered in the beginning, I will call your attention to it's the last page of the document, the table that you have before you, and it is 256J.626, subdivision 8C, items 1 and 2. It's section 15 of the bill as it's currently drafted, but our author's amendment takes that out of this bill because we've actually included that amendment in another department bill, and so to avoid being duplicative and having it in two different areas, we've taken it out of this bill, and it is included in a different bill.
Thank you. That completes the presentation. Is there anyone else that wishes to be heard from the audience on this bill? Seeing no one, I'll open it up to questions from the committee. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, what's the next stop for this bill?
The next stop, I think, is judiciary.
Okay, and Madam Chair, with us having already passed Senator Hayden's bill and nearly identical language there, could you help me understand, are they both moving forward? Is one going in an omnibus bill? What are we doing?
Where did your bill on the cultural
council?
Is yours gone to state local? Yes.
Chair,
Senator Hayden.
Bill went to state local communities. My bill went to state and local. It was originally, at least I asked that question of staff, that it was already in this bill, and then there was some in the presentation. I think that there was some talk around with members about making sure we pull that out. There was a conversation around diversity and disparate issues, and so they're kind of running concurrently only because we wanted to ensure that we had a good conversation about the issue.
Will it go to finance from there?
Madam Chair, I just trying to think about if there's a cost.
Yes, okay. So, but not referred to judiciary.
Not for us.
I see. It's in our, okay, sorry, now I'm oriented to that. So I think that they'll just be moving concurrently.
Okay, and Madam Chair, come together in finance and clean up the language? Is that...
I think that they could actually both pass through finance and then be resolved as they. I think that if there's finance, it would be Senator Laurie's committee that would incorporate which of these and what set of language would go into the overall omnibus bill.
Okay.
Any further discussion on Senator Franzen's 872? Seeing none, I need a motion from Senator Marty to move Senate File 872 as amended and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Now we have Senate File 887 from Senator Marty. Welcome to the table, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Department of Health omnibus policy bill. Has an unusual collection of provisions in it. And I'll go through them very briefly, and I do have, well, maybe put the bill in shape. I'd like to have an A2 and an A3 amendment. I'd like to move the A2 amendment, if that's appropriate.
Senator Marty moves the A2 amendment to Senate File 887. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Passes.
And then, Madam Chair, I have an A3 amendment as well.
Senator Marty moves the A3 amendment to Senate File 887.
Madam Chair, on that amendment, wanted to, excuse me, on page 2 of the amendment, line 16, wanted to strike the word gross and incorporate that into that amendment if I can. So I'll move it, the amendment, with that change incorporated. So it would be a violation, would be a misdemeanor instead of gross misdemeanor.
With that additional verbal friendly amendment to the amendment, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Madam Chair, the bill does several things. The first section, first portion of the bill, section one, is a rate on awareness. When somebody is selling a house, they're supposed to be reporting things they know about the house. Radon is one of the higher risk issues in real estate transactions that you should be disclosing. This would be spelling it out in more details. I just talked with the realtors today who have some concerns about they may be testifying on this, but they've said they're willing to continue working on it. We think that the form might be able to be simpler, fewer questions and things like that. And obviously they can tell you concerns, but obviously the more paper we provide at real estate transactions, the less any one has impact. But I think radon awareness is a key point. Again, if you don't have any knowledge of radon in your house, you're not going to be reporting it. I know I've lived in the same house for close to 3 decades, and we took care of ours about 20 years ago. It'd be pretty obvious because it's got a fan running 24/7. But we would have to disclose that we've had it tested and that we took action and so on. If you haven't done it, you could just be checking a box. We have no knowledge. If you've been tested, you'd have to disclose the results and so on. The second thing in the bill, and this is beginning section 2, TB prevention. And there are several sections of the bill here that relate to the same thing. Sections 2, 3, and 4, and also 12 through 14. The CDC updated its best practices on TB several years ago. We're basically just changing the law to direct them to follow the CDC's current practices. Again, I don't think these are controversial things. I mean, the first one may have, I mentioned the concerns about that, but this is for the supervised living facilities in Section 2, for hospital licensure in 3, and 4 is the boarding care home providers. Then Section 5 through 11, the hospital adverse events reporting law, we'd be adding several types of events. You can see in Section 5, 6, surgery or other invasive procedures. That's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 through 11. Those are the adverse reporting things. Then Sections 12 through 14, as I mentioned, other TB reporting things. Section 15, Uniform Consumer Information Guide. for hotels and other types of facilities. We're clarifying we don't have to give those same notifications to homeless people in a homeless shelter. That's current practice, but the law technically says they're supposed to. Section 16, right now, every odd year, we'd be switching every fifth year. Poison Information Center, RFP, HCMC's had the state contract for 30 years. For the past 5 or 6 years, nobody else is bidding for it. Realistically, they're the only ones who are able to and interested in providing it. We think 5 years, which is standard, I believe, for other department grants like that. Section 17 through 17 and 18 are liability coverage for emergency medical reserve corps people who are coming in from other states, clarifying that the coverage that they have includes not just the actual events they're coming here for, but practice events as well and so on. Sections 19, criminal background studies. This would be permissive authority to conduct criminal background checks for
same volunteers.
This is for the volunteers, those same Medical Reserve Corps volunteers. Some of them are behavioral health volunteers working with vulnerable people, and they're not asking to do this for everyone, but they'd like to have the permissive authority to do so. I don't think there's any controversy over this. Section 20, we're just clarifying that occupational therapy practitioner, the definition of it, it's just a clarification language. Sections 21 through and 20 are occupational therapy practitioner and...
It's also a clarification.
Oh, it's clarification language. I'm sorry. Matthew Colley, maybe we should have him, presenting this. Sections 21 is for... sexually transmitted infections, particularly gonorrhea and chlamydia, would allow field workers to dispense single-pill antibiotics. We passed similar legislation a few years ago where a doctor would be prescribing, it's a single-dose antibiotic, and we're trying to get at the spread of these diseases and so on. This would allow field workers to dispense them. Section 23 is body art repeal. I think we're taking out the second repealer here in the paragraph B in the amendment because we're bringing back into the bill something that was a separate bill, was part of this, and then got taken out and so on. And that is with body art. Body art tattooing and piercings and so on, that they would... first of all, that violations of the law would be a misdemeanor. Apparently, there's some confusion because they do have some civil penalties, and it wasn't clear that a violation was a violation of the law, which is standard practice, would be a misdemeanor. Department had originally come in with a gross misdemeanor. I suggested all you need is to have it as a penalty. I don't think people are going to be flaunting the law. If they do, they can come in and make the case. There are other changes in this. I don't think any of them are controversial. I think there are some people here who can testify to the importance of the changes. One is for people who are coming here for temporary events.
They're all technical.
They're basically technical changes, and be happy to stand for questions on any of them. And then the other change is, I believe, purely the A2 amendment had... athletic trainers, I know they talk about other things that may have been controversial in terms of licensing, but these are technical changes. I think you can get the sense of this from the amendment. They've checked with the OT and PT folks. They don't have any concerns. The department's fine with it. This did not come from the department, but I'll let Mr. Cowley speak for it, but I don't have any objections to it here. And again, I'm happy to stand for questions on any of that or on the bill itself. Ed, I'd ask for your support, and we have a number of witnesses, perhaps starting with Mr. Cowley from the department.
Thank you. Senator Marty, I was just looking at trying to read a sentence that just didn't seem to make any sense to me. So I'm going to have, I'll just ask Ms. White to read the sentence and see if it makes any sense to her, and if not, clean it up. Oh, it is amended, this language. Ah, that is in one of your amendments. Thank you. Okay, we'll proceed then with Matthew Colley, Legislative Director of the Department of Health. Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Matthew Colley. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. Actually, with Senator Marty's presentation, I would just be rehashing what he had gone over. So if there are any aspects of that presentation that aren't as clear as someone would like it to be, I'd be happy to answer questions. Otherwise, I would happily reserve testimony.
Typically, we go through all the testifiers first, but is there anybody from the committee that has questions for the department at this time? Seeing none, we'll go ahead then. Hang in there, though, in case some questions come up eventually. Joseph Trowbridge from Anchor's Ends Tattoo, and Shan Anderson with Electric Dragonland Tattoo, and Vernon Musselman, the Holy Mackerel. Those are the next testifiers. We'll start with Anchor's End and Electric Dragonland. Those names. Just clean up stuff.
Madam Chair, committee, I guess Joseph is not here this evening. I'm Sean Anderson, owner of Electric Dragonland Tattoo Studio in Hopkins, Minnesota. I'm also the past president of the Alliance Professional Tattooists. This law was, we helped on the original formation of this law, which is based upon almost wholly upon the Hennepin County law that I helped them write years previous. So far as to what we have seen, the proposed changes, we agree with the majority of it. We do not agree with making it from a gross misdemeanor into a misdemeanor. There are people flaunting the law. It has been a problem. And it is a health issue. The way it is now, with just a monetary or a civil penalty, they're just going to go ahead and keep doing it. I believe that's one of the reasons why that law, that change was to be put in there. I believe that it would be, if you don't make it a gross misdemeanor, it's not going to stop anybody from tattooing underground, which I think is the idea behind it. One of the other issues that I did have was the license after lapse portion. Is that still in there?
From
the paperwork that it was given to me, that's under the technical and housekeeping amendments.
Should be in.
And we.
What is the answer to the question?
Is it in this here? It's not in there. I'm sorry. It was in the information that was given to me by the health department, but not what I saw this evening. I didn't see this until last week. So at that time, other than that, we do agree with putting a penalty, beyond the civil penalty, and we do believe that it should be a gross misdemeanor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shan. Did you want to speak to that right now, Senator Marty, about the misdemeanor versus gross misdemeanor?
Madam
I know
Chair,
this committee is going to go to this bill right. Will go to judiciary, so we can continue to have this conversation.
Right. And we can continue to discuss it there. The whole point is 90 days in jail and I think $700 fine right now. In effect, law enforcement can get involved here then because they have the criminal penalty. If somebody keeps flaunting the law, 90 days in jail is not something, you can't operate a business from jail. And if they do it again, I mean, you start having things pile up. I guess what I'd like to say is generally for licensing laws, if people are violating them, I think a misdemeanor is a reasonable penalty. I don't have strong objection to the gross misdemeanor, but I think it's the kind of thing we should wait and see. It's not been a criminal penalty enforced at all. Now we're saying misdemeanor. I'm happy to come back if it's worse, but I don't see it being a problem. Not that it's not being ignored now, but there's no criminal penalty now.
Okay, and this will be discussed further. I am also on judiciary, so I'll be interested. And because I'm new there, maybe this committee would like to know it as well. What is the difference of penalty between the misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor?
Misdemeanor is 90 days in jail. Gross misdemeanor is up to a year in jail.
Okay.
And it's 3,000, I may be outdated, but I think it's either 700 or 900 for misdemeanor penalties and 3,000 for gross misdemeanor.
And Senator Marty, if a person commits a misdemeanor by violating this law and they do it a second time or a third time because of the concern that it isn't an adequate penalty, is there a point at which the license gets revoked?
Oh, Madam Chair, the license would be gone right away. I mean, if somebody's doing criminal acts against their license, I defer to the health department by how they deal with it, but I will guarantee you any license holder, DHS or Department of Health, is going to lose their license over that. I mean,
so even with a misdemeanor?
Yeah.
Okay.
In other words, the problem we have here is there's no criminal penalty and saying there's civil fines, and that's apparently not enough. I understand that. I appreciate that the industry is coming in and saying we want to have penalties so we can keep the bad actors out. I appreciate that. I'm happy to work with you, happy to talk with you further about it, but I really think a misdemeanor penalty will accomplish it. And you can see if that doesn't work, I'm happy to come back and we can talk more in judiciary.
Great,
well.
Thank you. And you'll do that, Mr. Anderson, continue the conversation.
You bet. And possibly, I mean, the way that this reads, again, I haven't been able to digest it in depth. It says any person who violates the provision of subdivision one, I believe, is that tattooing without a license? Is that subdivision one? I believe because I don't believe, think any of us think that it should be a gross misdemeanor for making a mistake under the law or under the ordinance, but blatantly flaunting the law and tattooing without a license, multiple repeat offenses, that's I'm open for discussion on that, but that's a misdemeanor, seems a little light.
It's clear that in relationship to our committee, the policy of strengthening the penalty because of the public health hazard is important. Where it should be, I think, can be further described in judiciary. So thank you very much for
that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I missed who you said was not able to be here this evening.
Joe Johns from Anchor's End.
Okay, thank you very much. So then the next person to testify is Vernon Musselman.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Vernon Musselman. Like you said, I own the Holy Mackerel. I am Minnesota's and St. Paul's only association professional piercer member in the state. There are two out of all the licensed members in the state, and I am only one of those. So I guess most of these things that we're addressing, I definitely take into consideration. I definitely agree with what Sean said. I definitely agree with what Senator Marty is saying. The biggest problem is, and to kind of quote what Senator Marty said, you know, you can't operate from jail. You can't operate a business from jail. Our concerns aren't necessarily with the people that are operating business now. Our concern is more with the people that are operating without a license, within their home. And we're seeing it on a daily basis, and not just on the tattoo side. We're seeing numerous infections, problems with piercings, things where we're constantly referring people to the hospital and to have treatment beyond anything that I can help them with. As far as Matt, who is my health department director, inspector, I mean, we've spoken numerous times about, you know, how do I report this? I have clients that I've photographed, taken some kind of documentation or testimony from. What do I do? You know, what's the next step? And it's not so much that I'm worried about the people in my industry breaking the law. I'm worried about people who are above and beyond the law because, A, we don't have the penalties that we're talking about, but, B, they don't care. They're making money. It's not as if it's legal to sell drugs in Minnesota. It's not. We all know that. But the people who sell drugs in Minnesota make money doing it. So, I mean, that might be a very harsh, exaggerated example, but it kind of feels that way to me in my industry. I feel like the people who don't bother to get licensed, that don't care about aseptic technique, they don't even know about it. All they know is that if they perform this, whether the work be good or bad, they're going to get paid. And if there's no way to enforce that, then, you know, it's going to continue to happen. And the gross misdemeanor would just, you know, I'm not saying that we need to imprison someone for a year for the first time that happens. They need to be warned first, but they need to know that the state's serious about the consequences, because you're basically licensing all of us in this room to say that we are safe, that you recognize that we know what we're doing and that we're safe, and you've licensed us to operate on the general public. These other people don't fall under that.
Thank you, Vernon. Senator Marty,
I think Mr. Musselman's talking about not licensed personnel, but what is there a process or a way of addressing what gets discovered in a licensed tattooing business that looks like somebody has done something that's a health issue by an unlicensed person. Is there a process in place for reporting that, and is there an adequate penalty for that?
Madam Chair, the Subdivision 1 apparently has just the licensure part, and so obviously if they're not behaving properly in one of their operations, they're going to lose their license. Their point is well taken that this is for those who are not going through the licensure process. And I'm very much concerned about, I don't want to have people doing unhealthy things. I'm not lockstep opposed to that, if so, and I'm happy to talk more between now and judiciary. In other words, I want to make sure we stop the problem. I'd love to hear more from these folks and the health department.
So it doesn't deal with that issue in this bill, but it's not as though we can't or don't. I see, Mr. Colley, would you like to speak to what can occur to a non-licensed person at this time? And then I'd like to stay focused on the bill following your testimony.
Madam Chair, again, Matthew Colley, Department of Health. The way that statute is currently set up, to my understanding, is that this would deal with both the licensed people as well as the unlicensed individuals, because it states within the statute that it is that if you are practicing body art, you must be licensed within the state. So the addition of the criminal penalty would apply to both instances. We do have a process to investigate anyone who is or is not licensed, and the concerns expressed by the testifiers so far gets at to the fact that when we have unlicensed individuals, the only thing that the department can do is an administrative penalty, which is difficult to assess on unlicensed individuals, also for the statements made by the testifiers.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I see another testifier, but the name I have here is Paul Eager.
Hi, I'm Tenneketh. I'm hard of hearing. Anyways, I want to
say... Would you say your name again slowly?
She's hard of hearing.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm Tanika Nolan. I'm hard of hearing. Thank you for working with me.
Sometimes
that's a good thing.
Can you spell your last name for me?
N-O-L-A-N.
Ms. Nolan, thank you.
Yes. And I just want to say, a lot of you are new faces I haven't seen, and I'm hoping to get to know you more. But I do know that Senator Marty had been a part of this from the beginning, and he does know what's going on and what has been going on. And I know that he will work with us with this issue, and I hope all of you will too. But I do know Senator Marty is an old-timer with it, so if I may say, sorry. But I know that he will work with us in the industry, as he has in the past, and I hope that all of you will be, and I thank you. I haven't had a whole lot of time to read all of this English, so if we could have a little more time or however, that would be great, or to work with you.
Thank you, Ms. Okay. Nolan. There will be time because there's a hearing. This is going to be referred to judiciary to deal with some of the issues you are here about, and Senator Marty has agreed to continue to have a conversation with you about that.
So
it's good. It's good.
Thank you.
All right. I'm still looking for Paul Eager. Is Paul with us? Paul is the Vice President of Governmental Affairs from the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I hope I'm saying your name correctly. But you can introduce yourself, and then I'll know for sure.
Madam Chair, my name is Paul Eager.
Eager.
Egger, with the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and we are a trade association, and our membership consists of the 17,000 realtors throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. And Senator Marty, I just want to thank him for taking the time this morning in a busy schedule to make a few minutes for us to discuss the radon awareness provisions in the bill, in the first portion of the bill. Madam Chair, I do want to say that the Minnesota Association of Realtors supports strong seller disclosure. And we do have a material fact disclosure statute in 513.52 through 13.60. And basically what that requires is that sellers must disclose all material facts of which the seller is aware that could adversely and significantly affect an ordinary buyer's use and enjoyment of the property or any intended use of the property of which the seller is aware. And that's current law, Madam Chair. One of the services that we do provide our members is we produce forms for the use in the real estate transaction. And we do have a seller disclosure form that's widely used in transactions throughout the state. And our seller disclosure form currently prompts sellers to disclose if radon concerns previously existed or currently exists. So that's something that we do currently in terms of our material fact disclosure. Madam Chair, one of the general concerns whenever a bill proposes to create a separate disclosure in state law outside of our material fact disclosure law, and Senator Marty touched on this in his opening comments, is that I think we run the risk of bombarding sellers with paperwork, and then the very purpose for which we're trying to call something out, it may get lost in the shuffle. And so one of the concerns is that perhaps we can work together and figure out a way to do this in a streamlined manner, consistent with the way we do other disclosures associated with the real estate transaction, and that the information provided to sellers or to buyers is meeting their needs and is not even more confusing than it could be. We are committed to working with Senator Marty on the language. As he mentioned and we discussed briefly this morning, often approaches that come forward in legislation are a starting point, and we can have further discussion about if the language achieves everything that it's meant to achieve in terms of raising awareness in the transaction. We also hope that we can work together with, in addition to Senator Marty and the House author, the Department of Health, to make sure that if any disclosure moves forward, that it's clear, concise, understandable, consistent with the way we disclose other material facts in the transaction. And just lastly, Madam Chair, radon is not an issue that's unique to people that happen to be buying and selling homes. And so to the extent that this committee, the Department of Health, the legislature can examine ways to raise awareness generally for all residents, I think that's important. I think it makes it even reduces the reliance of doing this at the point of sale, which, again, is only going to touch people that happen to be buying and selling their homes. And I thought I heard Senator Marty mention that he'd been in his house for 30 years. My parents have been in their house for 42 years. A lot of people aren't moving every couple of years. And so this is one approach to raising awareness, but certainly we hope that the focus will be more broad and focus more on the general public as you move forward. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my remarks.
Well, thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps this is to Mr. Colley, but are there other housing disclosures the Department of Health is interested in? Lead disclosures, formaldehyde and carpet, mold. I'm concerned that once we start one, somebody's going to get a really good idea and we're going to end up with a booklet of required disclosures when you sell a house. And I just want to make sure that we're balancing the health with the burdensome nature of tracking all of this and reporting all of it.
Mr. Colley.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, yes, that's one of the reasons why the Department of Health has put forward the language that it did. Because radon is so significant to homes in the state of Minnesota, and we find that there is a high percentage of homes within the state, well above that of the national average, that have radon in there. And we don't want to go down the road of having disclosures for everything, but this, because this one is such unique to homes, and the fact that to go at towards the sale of homes, radon is not a consistent thing that happens. Once you test once, you never have to test again. As foundations shift, circumstances change, the fact that we heat and cool our homes to a great degree within the state can all change how much radon may or may not be coming out of the ground into the home. So we want to get the information out that we possibly can to as many people as can on this issue so that they may take appropriate standards if necessary.
So, Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Cawley, so there are no other required disclosures from the Department of Health. This would be the first.
I would have to check. Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Benson.
Mr. Cawley.
I would have to check on that aspect. I do not know of any other disclosures from the Department of Health at the time of sale.
And Madam Chair and perhaps
Senator Benson,
Senator Marty or Mr. Cawley, my concern is that once we have one and it's a good idea, then there become a whole bunch of other really good ideas, and it becomes hard for legislators to say no, because then we get a testimony about lead paint and we get testimony about formaldehyde, and pretty soon we have a whole stack of disclosures. And so while this may be a good idea, it's the first, and I want us to be very cautious about the path we're going down.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I agree with you that we don't want to be willy-nilly doing this, and I think the realtors will tell you, and the staff person who recently bought it in place, and you sign a lot of documents. We do have disclosure of things like formaldehyde and lead paint. We have a lot of those disclosures already. The difference, one of the things here, first of all, most Minnesotans, I would guess, are not aware of it, but the fact is there are probably, I don't know what percentage of Minnesota homes have levels of radon that are worse than smoking a pack a day of cigarettes in terms of lung disease risk, lung cancer risk, and so on. And it's totally invisible. Nobody has a clue of it. We tested about 5 years after we bought our house. Ours is over the action threshold, but not that much over, and we took us another 4 years, 5 years to do something about it. But it's the kind of thing that I think this is my concern, and the realtors, I think, have a good point. When you see, and I think in your packets you have what the form would look like based on what's in the legislation, and I think we could reduce some of the questions, or make it simpler, figure out a way to do that. But I think it's actually a very important thing to be required, and I think you could argue already, if you know something about it, you have to disclose that you know something, but it bypass. I understand your concern, don't want to add a lot. We already have a lot of requirements. This is adding one more, but I think we're trying to do it, and I think our work in the next couple of weeks has to be, see, can we simplify this so it's not as intrusive.
Senator Marty, my understanding, though, and Senator Benson, I'm listening to your comments, is that this is not a requirement that a radon testing be done as a part of a selling process or a lead testing. This is not a requirement that the testing be done. This simply is elevating the fact that it has to be reported if it's known. That's a change that hasn't been required to be reported to the buyer if testing has been done and there's known information? Mr. Eager.
Right now I think that would be a material disclosure you should be doing. This is a little, because of the fact that there's so many steps, if you look at the form that should be in your packet, first item, seller has no knowledge of radon concentrations. Never tested. I don't know. I have a feeling that's what most homes would be right now. Radon test has been conducted. If it's been conducted, you want to basically make sure you've shared the results and let people know, and I'm sure a seller would say we've taken action to address it.
Okay.
So it's a lot more vague, but in general, you should be, under current law, you should be disclosing this, and the question is, how do we make sure the disclosure happens in a responsible way?
And that's what Mr. Egger is saying, that it's already under current law, without being as specific, it ought to be reported now, and your interest is in making certain that there's not a new form or a new process above and beyond, that it's integrated in some way that allows for this to happen but doesn't have another process, separate process?
Madam Chair, I think Senator Marty did a good job of answering the question that under current law under our current material fact disclosure, if a seller is aware of a radon issue, radon concern, that that is something that should be disclosed to the buyer. So that was to the point you raised a second ago. To your second point, whether it could be integrated, I think that's something that we'd certainly want to visit with Senator Marty about. Our current seller disclosure form that most realtors use throughout the state is roughly 9.5 pages long. It deals with a number of different issues, and it also allows the seller to identify other issues that aren't specifically called out. In this case, radon is one of the prompts that we have in our current seller disclosure form. There may be a way in looking at the bill and working with the health department, Senator Marty, that we could streamline the disclosure and really incorporate that into our existing form in some manner and streamline it in that way.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Colley, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, statements are true. What we're trying to get at here is the fact that those who haven't tested because they are unaware of the issue of radon within the state, they can legitimately and in good faith check that they don't know of any issue pertaining to radon on that disclosure form that was mentioned. What the department is trying to do is make sure that people are aware of the fact that radon is an issue, that in addition to the form, we'd be providing documentation that discusses the risks of radon within the state, and that's when they are checking, no, I don't know of any issues pertaining to radon. It's an informed check that it's not just, I haven't ever thought about it, but actually, no, I don't know about it, no, I haven't tested, so that then they may decide, the buyer may decide, oh, I will want to get my house tested because I'm now aware of the potential issues for radon. So it's awareness in addition to a disclosure.
Yes, I think I understand. Are there other questions in the committee? You know, I think that you're using the seller disclosure list as a place to do education about radon to a buyer. And what Mr. Egger is saying is you like the idea of more community information about the dangers of radon, but it shouldn't only be assigned to the responsibility of the buy-seller agreement, and that you don't want a process adding too much complexity to an already long form, 9-page form, that a seller has to fill out in relationship to the sale of their house. And you're going to continue to work on that. Okay, great.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Marty renews his motion to move Senate File 887 as amended and be referred to Judiciary. Any further discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Say nay. Passes. And referred to Judiciary. Okay, where are we at? Senator Wicklund has Senate File 894. They have a chance to do it. Should be able to get out of here pretty soon. Welcome, Senator Wicklund. Senator Wicklund moves Senate File 894 pass this committee and be referred to the floor. Do you have any amendments to the bill, Senator?
No, I do not.
Okay, great. Would you present the bill, please? Thank you.
Yes. I'm here tonight to speak about Senate File 894, which is healthcare facilities resident case mix classification provisions modifications. This proposal, it updates statutes pertaining to the reimbursement system for nursing home and boarding care residents. It deletes references to outdated payment classifications, makes conforming modifications to federal guidelines, clarifies certain requirements, and combines certain audit types. And with me tonight is Marcy Martinson, and she's going to be the speak in more detail about this bill from the
Thank
Department
you.
Of Health.
Welcome, Mrs. Martinson. Mrs. Martinson was with the Department of Health.
Yes, my name is Marcy Martinson. I'm the Case Mix Review Program Manager for the Compliance Monitoring Division of the Department of Health. What we are trying to do primarily is simplify, clarify language in the statute, and also to remove outdated language in the statute. The assessment form that is used for Minnesota case mix classification is the minimum data set, which is a federal form. And the first subdivision here, the definitions, the federal government has clarified and revised some of their definitions. We are just changing our definitions to conform with theirs so that it is not confusing to the public and to the providers who are presenting this information. In subdivision 3, a plethora of language that is no longer applicable is being removed. This is all from the RUG 3 classification system that was removed December 31st of 2011. Since January 1 of 2012, we have been using RUG 4. So subdivision 3 has removed all of that language about RUG 3, which is no longer needed. Subdivision, the language in the subdivision 3A is all just clarifying language. There's nothing that is special and different there, changing words like domains to categories, classes to classifications. We are just, again, conforming with the language that providers are used to seeing in the federal manuals. In subdivision 4, there is an addition under annual assessment where we are adding within 92 days of the previous assessment. Annual assessments only need to be done annually. However, they also need to be done within 3 months or 92 days of the previous assessment, whether that was a significant change in status or quarterly. We're also adding language for the significant corrections to prior comprehensive or a prior quarterly assessment. This is current practice. It somehow was never put in the statute. However, it is current practice. This is just modifying a previous assessment. And when the modifications are to the point where they would need to revise the resident's care plan, then the federal government says you also need to do a significant correction. In subdivision 5, we are removing language about residents who enter and leave the facility regularly. This language is not needed as it is addressed in the federal long-term care users manual. There is clarifying language in subdivision 6. We're removing language related to RUG 3. And we are referencing the federal manual for the MDS. It's a common manual that is used by all providers for coding the MDS. In subdivision 8, we are changing some language about requesting a reconsideration. Residents have the right to request, and their families, a reconsideration of their case mix classification, and then it will be looked at back at the department. The facilities also, when we do an audit, have the right to request a reconsideration. We are just clarifying language of the information that they need to send with us, with it to us, so that we can look at the information. We are also clarifying that if a resident requests a reconsideration of their case mix classification, and they will need the documentation from the facility so that we can audit the record, that they will not have to pay the facility for those copies. And that's also under subdivision 8. If a facility requests a reconsideration, we want to make sure that a facility has the opportunity, if they forget to send us something, that they get a second chance. And the way the statute has read in the past, if the facility did not send all of the information in, it was an automatic denial. So we want to add an opportunity for us to call them and say, we're missing this document, and we need this document. I don't think that is controversial to the facilities at all. Then in subdivision 9, which is our audit authority, so that we can go out and do some quality control, we have three types of audits that are completed that the statute allows. The most common audit is done on every state fiscal year. It's called a pool audit. Also, we have had targeted and special audits, which have very seldom been used in the past. We want to remove the language for the target audit and combine it with the special audit. Again, it's just clarifying it, making it more friendly to the individuals who would be using the statute. So we would remove all of the language for the target audit and take any of the language that would be necessary and put it under the special audit. These kinds of audits, maybe we do one every 2-3 years. So it's not common that we would be doing these. And that's the majority of the changes. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Martinson. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on Senate File 894? I see Toby Pearson and Carrie Thurlow are approaching the table.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm joined by Carrie Thurlow, Aging Services of Minnesota. Together we act as the long-term care imperative here at the Capitol. When we were looking at the language on the case mix review program, we noticed that there was one thing that they had omitted that we had previously thought would be in the bill.
Mr. Pearson, would you pull that microphone up real close?
Choke up on the microphone?
Yeah, you can almost swallow it.
Specifically, the area that we have a concern is the penalties for late submission. When we had previously looked at the language, we had understood that there was going to be a section saying the commissioner may reduce the penalty. In our conversations with the department just prior to this hearing, they told us that the reason that that was removed is that it created a fiscal consequence and they wanted to keep this as a policy bill. So we've agreed to work with the department on possibly inserting our request on that a commissioner may waive or reduce the penalty in a next upcoming bill, but we just wanted you to be aware of the consequence of that. The omission of that creates challenges for our facilities.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Okay, great. Is there anyone from the committee that has a question for Senator Wicklund or any of the testifiers on Senate File 894? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund renews her motion to pass Senate File 894.
Is it amended? No.
And that it be referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. All right, then our final bill this evening is Senate File 825, also Senator Wicklund. This is the Minnesota Medical Practice Act modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an author's amendment for this bill.
The author's amendment is included in your packet. It's amendment, the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. Senator Wicklund moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 825. Any discussion? Is there anything about the amendment that you think we should know, Senator Wicklund?
Do you want to comment on it when you get to that part of the testimony? I think we can discuss it
when we have the bill put together already.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say nay. Amendment passes.
Thank you very much, Senator Wicklund. This bill is Senate File number 825, and it has to do with making changes to the Medical Practice Act. This, in the 2012 legislature, there was a Sunset Advisory Commission bill And the Commissioner of Health, the legislature and the Commissioner of Health were required to convene a 15-member working group to evaluate the Minnesota Medical Practice Act. As a result of their work, there were recommendations made. The working group met six times between August and December to discuss the Medical Practice Act. Senator Sharon was on that that committee, as well as Senator Hahn. And the final report that the task force created was unanimously agreed to by the members in attendance. And the legislative recommendations are non-controversial housekeeping or technical changes. And with us here tonight, I have a member of the committee, a consumer member,
yes.
I believe, Malcolm Mitchell. And he is going to speak and discuss the bill in greater detail with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome, Mr. Mitchell, and not only a citizen member, but was diligently engaged in chairing this very interesting committee that I did serve on and attend as frequently as I could. So please, would you go through the changes or the recommendations of the committee? And I would be interested, this was an outcome of the Sunset Commission that was asking all boards and commissions to review their task and to determine the value of their commission. I'd be curious to know if you think that this process was a worthy effort, and because it was a big group of people, a lot of really dedicated people that had other things to do that come to these committee hearings to achieve this goal. So I'd be interested to know whether you think it was an added value.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Malcolm Mitchell. I was privileged to chair the Medical Practice Act work group. As you've heard, it was created and directed by the last legislature to study the Medical Practice Act to ensure that the act, as it says, quote, effectively protects the safety and well-being of the citizens of the state and allows transparency. It was a 15-member group, as said. It was a very diverse group of people representing physicians, academia, health services, consumers, medical practice experts, and state legislators. As you heard, your chair was a member of that group. At the first meeting of the group, they decided that they should appoint a consumer as the chair, and I was therefore elected as chair. We met for six times, as said earlier. The staff from the Division of Management Analysis and Development provided facilitation services and actually wrote the final report. I might say that I think it was very well worth it. There was participation and active participation of all. I think the members were really diligent about attending and about participating actively in the discussion, very forthright, and I think it was useful to, particularly in the sense of transparency, to have the discussion we did and to understand what's happening in terms of the Medical Practice Act and the operations of the Medical Practice Board. The Minnesota Department of Health maintained work group information on their website, so it was public. The Board of the Medical Practice, and there are some representatives here tonight if you'd like to ask any questions, staff from the Department of Health, work group members, and other related parties presented a great deal of information, I'd call in-depth information, on a variety of pertinent topics. In our assessing of the Act, we were focused on the question of public safety and allowing for transparency. So we talked a lot about that. As part of the process, we compared what we have in Minnesota with other states, particularly Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and Washington State. We looked at our act in comparison with the Federation of State Medical Boards Model Act, and we worked as a group to identify key issues that we thought were important, and then we prioritized those issues and went through a sort of a monthly process of going through those issues. We collected information from a variety of sources, including the Medical Practice Board itself, which spent a lot of time with us, the Minnesota Department of Health staff. We worked with information, recognized really the overview of the state's data privacy laws, because we discovered we got into transparency, that a lot of these issues relate very directly to the privacy laws in the state of Minnesota. We collected information from the Department of Health's Healthcare Workforce Analysis Program. We heard testimony from the state's Health Professional Service Program, which is a diversion program referenced in the bill later. We heard a briefing by the legislative auditor on his October 23rd report to the legislature about the Medical Care Act. Through that process, all very open, I think we gave the public an opportunity to be heard and provide inputs into the process. After our study and analysis was completed, and a result of that, we concluded that there were no meaningful public safety or transparency gaps or issues regarding the act. As I said before, we did talk a lot about transparency. We did find in the end that we felt that there's a balance between the public's right to know and privacy concerns, and we felt that we're in good shape regarding those. At the same time, we did conclude that there were opportunities to enhance public information and public understanding about the act, about the processes used by the Medical Practice Board, and we made a series of recommendations regarding that. Those are not part of this bill because they really don't take legislative action. But they did do things like identify, collect the kind of aggregate information that we ought to collect, and how we should inform interested parties about that. It talked about disseminating that information, and some of that process on public websites, et cetera, is underway. We talked about increasing the level of participation by physicians in the annual survey of physicians. I think about 55% respond now, and the Department of Health, working in coordination with the Medical Board, are looking for ways to make that a higher level of participation, thereby giving us more information into the aggregate data that can be distributed and understood. We did then identify a number of housekeeping items. Those would take some legislative action to implement. We worked with the Office of the Revisor of Statutes that would produce this, and therefore we have Senate File 285. And that Senate file contains all of these housekeeping items now that it's amended. The need for the amendment was because there were a couple omissions in that in the bill that was originally lettered. And I can go through each of those, or I can sort of stand for questions as you design. I might say that all of the recommendations that are brought forth to you and in the general transparency area were unanimously approved by the work group. I do not believe they are controversial, and I know that the Medical Practice Board also agrees with those recommendations and is supportive as they were approved by the task force or the work group. If you'd like, it's up to you whether you want me to go through each one, but I can real quickly.
You know, if you could quickly go through each of the sections, that would be helpful.
Okay. Section 1 is to put into the statute the phrase Minnesota Medical Practices Act. It is not currently there and gives it what we all call it anyway, so we felt that that should be added. In Section 2, Subdivision 1, you'll see the change: not less than one board member must hold a degree of doctor of osteopathy. We did understand in the conversation with the group that sometimes there are more than one osteopath who are eligible and would be interested in serving, but the way the language reads now, you could have not more than one. So now it says not less than one is the way the new language reads. Section 3, you'll see that in, I think, line 27 is the amendment added, because we needed to add language about the National Board of Osteopathic Examiners. That's on the amendment. Section later on in the same section, you'll see the top of page 3, which is section 3.2 there. Again, the amendment relating to taking the College of Osteopathic Medical Licensure Examination and must pass all three steps within 6 attempts. That's to clarify the role of the osteopaths in Minnesota as well and licensure. On 3.8, the applicant, instead of shall, may, the change is to may make arrangements with the executive director to appear in person. We discovered in our discussion, and we realized that current technology allows us to do what was there so that they could be sure that the same person who was applying was the person who they saw. With video conferencing, with Skype and other things, we don't really need to do that in every case, particularly when it's a long travel distance and it costs that applicant a lot of money to come to Minnesota to just be visible for a few minutes in that process. The last two items are the last sections, Section 4, Section 5. The diversion program, which has been a very successful program, we heard a lot about that in state law sections 214.31 to 214.36. There is no reference to it in the Medical Practice Act. This is an attempt to put it right into the Act so we clarify that it's part of the role and an understanding of a real diversion process. And the last one, just clarifying again that allied health professionals are under the oversight of the board, the medical practice board. So that's the amendment.
Thank you very much for that overview. Are there anyone else that's here that wishes to speak to this Medical Practices Act modifications bill? Seeing no one, is there anyone on the committee that has a question? Well, I guess not, but it's great. Thank you. I'm sure it's because you were so clear in your presentation that there
Thank
are no
you.
Questions. But, you know, this was, you know, a committee that was pulled together for a lot of reasons, the Sunset Commission, but also the public, especially your program to help the public understand the transparent and increase the transparency, because there was concerns about how we do deal with difficulties in the profession, complaints against professionals, or how we allow people to have an opportunity to move into recovery rather than into a disciplinary process. So that there was a big expose about that at one time that created some angst. So this is an outcome of that. It's we found that the process was transparent, was adequate, may need some more public information, and then to make these modifications.
Madam Chair, let me add just one thing I overlooked. As I said, we did hear from the auditor, the legislative auditor, and I would just say that in the report that you received, it's part of our final report, they didn't also see a need for further evaluation and investigation of the procedures and the process of the Board of Medical, the Minnesota Medical Board. So we listened to them as well.
Yeah, I really want to have you emphasize that, because part of the impetus of this was a suggestion that there was the board had a lack of response to physician errors or misconduct, and that's what the board was reviewing and determined that the process was in place, but informing the public better how the Medical Practices Act Board responds to those things would be helpful. Correct?
Correct.
That's correct. Okay, seeing no further questions to come before us, Senator Wicklund renews her motion to pass Senate File 825 as amended, and that it be referred to the floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Whoops.
Opposed? Nay. Passes and goes to the floor. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Mitchell.
You.
Seeing that there's no more business before the committee, we are adjourned.